Okay, everyone, I'd like to get started and welcome you all to the Francis E. Clark Lectureship Series for 2011. This is actually a pretty exciting one for myself, as we're linking up with the Canadian Society of Soil Science in conjunction with the Soil Science Society of America. And our guest speaker today is well known on both fronts, has been on both sides of the borders for numerous parts of his career, which he's going to talk about today. So I'm very pleased that Elder Paul was willing to give this year's Francis E. Clark Lectureship. Now, Elder has a very long history, and so he told me that I had to be very brief, so meaning underline the word brief. So all I am going to mention is his academic credentials, and then he's going to take you on a whirlwind tour through his long, illustrious career. So he did both his bachelor's and master's degree at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. So there's the big Canadian connection up in the cold north. Then he was off to the University of Minnesota, where he completed his PhD. Next was to Berkeley, California, for an appointment there, followed by, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. He went back north over the border and spent 21 years in a career there, before then deciding he needed to go south, probably to escape the winters, and went to Berkeley, California. Then Michigan State, and then finally he's in the gorgeous Colorado state at the University of Colorado. So, University of Colorado, did I screw up? See, we don't have all this in Canada where you got state universities and other, it's just too confusing. Anyway, okay, with that, I would like to welcome Elder to give the Clark Lectureship.
Right, the young people in this room by giving this Clark lecture 20, 30 years from now are going to be very, very different and many advances from the wonderful advances that I've been involved in during the last few years. And you notice she was told not to give the years I graduated.
Next one.
So I thought I'd do one fun slide. I've always been involved with interest in the academic merits of his elder down the bottom. Ed Schmidt was a graduate of Robert Starkey, who was a graduate of Salomon Waksman. Salomon Waksman took his master's with Jacob Lippmann at Rutgers University. Jacob Lippmann, exactly 100 years ago, wrote that interesting book, Bacteria and Country Life, 1 year after Lanus's book that I basically interpret as Bacteria Relative to Soil Management. I did not find the PhD supervisor for Salomon, so I still got a bit more work to do. I think the other part that people keep talking to me about is academic uncles and cousins, etc. And I had fun deciding the first time which four people I would choose for this thing that sort of influenced me. The one I started in was H.L. Janssen. I took my master's degree with J.D. Newton at the University of Alberta on biological life and fixation. And Janssen had written a review at that time that would be very appropriate to fill in with this lecture here on the Haber-Bosch process that review was called Biological Nitrogen Fixation in Feeding the World. Now, these are both positive and negative. To some extent, the biological nitrogen fixation I was trying to work on was the free living, and I was 15 years ahead of my time in methodology. I would like you to think about working on the most important problem that you are fairly certain you can solve. I've taken a few wrong turns in my career. Not sorry for them, because if you don't take those, you maybe not take the right ones. Walter Libby developed carbon dating, which I've been involved with all my life, and you will see many years of carbon dating, nearly as long as old as the ages I'm talking about. Madame Kononova, translated her book on soil organic matter that reviewed all of the Russian scientific work and firmly based on humic acids, and touted against Waksman's lignoprotein theory, strongly influenced my initial work on soil organic matter. And the last person is F.E. Clark, he of the very sharp critical mind and the sharper pencil, read typewriter in writing, that Francis and I worked together for many years in book reviewing and reviews. We also have to thank Francis. Many of you probably don't know that he dabbled in the stock market in addition to his job with USDA, and it's the profits from that that are making it possible for us to be in this room together. Next one. I'm going to talk, and also think of my life. I've had a number of fairly different sojourns, but basically I've been involved in organisms and organic matter. In organisms, we're going to look at biomass today. Of course, they carry on the decomposition. More and more, as we look at the modern soil organic matter work, the microbial products are gaining larger and larger importance as part of soil organic matter production. And then community structure. Do organisms matter in decomposition? Of course they matter, they do the decomposition, but how important is the community structure? And we'll be addressing a little bit. Organic matter, we'll look at the chemistry of it, and I use the word matrix, I like that word, to tie together all the physical, chemical protection, silt, clay, the interactions, the physical inability even of organic matter within organic matter, dynamics, which has always been a subject of my interest for many years. I use the word ecosystem, function, probably in an agronomy meeting I should have used soil fertility, but soil fertility certainly falls in the middle of ecosystem function and then global change. It's people list their people in their labs, can't so I wrote this in as Canadian co-authors, and the Canadians in the room will probably recognize everybody but except Ken McCallum. And I want all of you to think, especially the younger people, about opportunities taken and not taken. Ken McCallum, the head of the chemistry department, who I didn't even know, had just developed a brand new carbon dating unit at the University of Saskatchewan and came to talk to Don Rennie and myself and said, I'm doing this for anthropology reasons. And every time we collect a bone sample, we always have to wipe out that damn soil. Not only do we have to get rid of the soil, but when we look at the carbon dates, we're finding out that the soil is quite old. So Elder, would you like to work with me on carbon dating of soil samples? And that work started a long-term thing. The other influence was Con Campbell, who's in the audience, just come to the University of Saskatchewan to work on salt phosphorus, and we completely mucked up his life by convincing him that he should work on carbon dating salt organic matter. The other co-authors I have, both U.S. and there, the list is far too long, but some of the people whose work I really will be working on today and has influenced my lifetime, and many of you will see yourself on this thing. The big thing is that the modern toys, the modern techniques and the modern interpretations are so complex, one person cannot work by themselves, and you're really working as much part of a larger group. I looked at some of the fancy new molecular approaches to solar structure. I decided to go with Rolly St. Arnaud's 50-year-old slide, thin section of the surface soil of a model soil or a turnitin. First thing you can see here is the people aren't wrong when they say the roots make up about 1% of the soil. You can see under normal light the sand particles, you can see the light fraction, the materials, and you can probably envision some of the aggregates that make up the particulate organic matter. Then if you go in a new slide from Ed Schmidt, who is my PhD supervisor, next one. Here it's showing the mycorrhizal fungi within that root structure. So this gives me a chance to show the organisms as well as the plants and the soil. So next one. And there's what it starts off at. I'm going to be talking about depth effects and disturbance, and you can see why we can get soil organic matter down there at 10,000 years. They just don't have many ways of getting around and attacking the substrates. So there's the subsurface soil. Okay, I've been very much involved on controls on soil organic matter. Pierre Grandi published a paper that said soils are different, but we really should be working on the concepts that are the underlying processes. And our papers should not only say how is our soil different, but where does our soil develop new and the understanding of better concepts. So we have the controls, the unifying concepts. The soils are similar. Then each of these controls, many of which I will talk about, operates in different methods. So each soil, therefore, is also unique because the controls are the same, but their impact is different. Next one. This picture by Schulten and Schnitzer. Schulten developed much of the pyrolysis techniques that I'm going to be talking about later. Morris Schnitzer was, of course, a Canadian, great soil organic matter studies. And in 1993, we thought we knew everything about soil organic matter. Here's this typical structure, idealized structure. We know that there's no one understood molecule of soil organic matter. But we looked at the idealized one. And I was fairly happy with, at that point in time, talking about that with the humic acid that represented soil organic matter. I'm happy with the clay interactions. I'm happy with the polyvalent bonds separating the ionic bonds, the hydrogen bonds, the van der Waals forces. At that point in time, they had come found out that the long-chain aliphatics that cause hydrophobicity were important. There's probably more aromatics in here than I would put in if I wrote did this thing today. And there's not nearly enough nitrogen, because as we're going to try and point out, nitrogen is a very important part of the soil organic matter structure. However, we'll forgive them. This was a pozole B humic acid that is low in nitrogen, so we'll forgive them for not having as much nitrogen in there as I would have liked. Next one. There's a phenomenal set of meetings in the European Society of Soil Science in Bari, Italy this summer. There's a few more empty seats up here. Come on up. I won't bite. It says, a modern understanding of humus chemistry indicates that soil organic matter is constituted by several thousands of different molecules associated in superstructures. Now here's the magical word. They're now using superstructure rather than humic materials. Stabilized by hydrophobic and hydrogen bonds, not much different than we had before. Heterogeneous molecules are the end products of biodegradation of plant litters, microbial metabolites. Their chemical structure, as well as their bioactivity, are still a function of physical soil properties. And here I object a little bit. They have lumped, this is a chemical section, so we'll forgive them. They have lumped all of physical protection, clay protection, cesspit oxides into physical structure. But in that word, if you change that to physical soil properties, to my last slide on the known controls of soil organic matter, I'd be fairly happy with that definition. The next one. So let's start getting down to data. So I said that we started carbon dating in Saskatchewan, and in this slide, from Milford. I believe this data from both Claude Campbell's original work. And Collins was, it's fun to be the first person entering a field, so we were the first people to fractionate soil organic matter and carbon date it. And what did we call it? Average age, Lord Seth's appeal. C14H doesn't signify the vast difference in ages that average out in the one number you're measuring. So we said, let's use mean residence time. When we went to publish the paper, of course the reviewers said, you're cheating. Mean residence time is a very carefully defined thing that depends on a certain first or zero order reaction on the soil in steady state. And we are very aware that a soil is never really in steady state. But we use mean residence time, and it has caught on, because it does signify this average of my age that fits into all of these different fractions that you eventually carbon date. So some more recent soil, I'm having these three palms, it's light fraction, plant material I showed you before, and the internal palm is the aggregates from incubation, and it has been a long time. You get about 3 years mean residence time for that, 12 years for that. We did the folic acids and the humic acids. The humic acids are now being attacked as they were in 1908 by Schreiner and Schori, who said soil organic matter is nothing but a bunch of plant products. They used the wet chemistry at that time, found 40 products and said that's enough. Waksman said humic acids are an artifact of the extraction technique, and therefore his proximal analysis and his lignoproteins was advertised and justified. It's a good thing he got his Nobel Prize in medicine. He'd have never got it in soil organic matter. The humic acids are a very nice, easily identifiable, large molecular weight, hard to decompose components that in this fractionation scheme, with the melted soil being 800 years, are the oldest fraction. The fulvic acids, those low molecular weight materials that after sodium hydroxide, sodium pyrophosphate extraction don't precipitate, are much younger. Let's go to a more functional fractionation. The silt.
Oops. Okay, you got
back,
it.
Back up, yeah. The other half of that. The silt makes up 22% of the soil, and they just a bit older than the whole soil. The coarse clay dates at 1250 years. In Saskatchewan, the fine clay seems to be the depository of a lot of microbial guts, as Vern called it. And both C14 and 15, and C14 tracers for the other thing, have shown that the fine clays are much younger than the coarse clays. Later on, I'll show you that the Colorado soils are miserable and they don't follow this story. The non-hydrolyzable carbon, we were looking for a quick and dirty technique to separate the old from the young. And knowing that the non-hydrolyzable does have problems, and I'll come back to that, dated the oldest of the fractions we've taken. Other people who've used oxidative techniques get much lower yields of carbon and much older portions. And those are just back to the envelope modeled calculations of what we would have got from Milford if we had used H2O2 or Na2S2O3. That's very, very old. Next one. If you had barley straw, or wheat straw in this case, to a soil, you get the very nice three-pool first-order reactions, a very fast decomposition rate, and an intermediate rate, and then a semi-stabilization, or approaching the asymptote. What's nice here is the scepter soil is a clay soil, and the wheat field is a loam. But the Canadians in the room will know that there's another interacting factor, the fact that the scepter is the gravel prairie, the wheat field is the forest grass transition. So you could use this as an argument that clays protect soil organic matter. You'd also use it as an argument that climate makes and vegetation makes a difference in the stabilization. But you get the very fast decomposition, and you get that stabilization out. Ron Follett in his work later on. Very often, you sort of stabilize out at about 10% of the carbon percent, stays in the soil for very long periods of time. Next one. This is an interesting slide. If you add sugar, you get a very, very rapid decomposition. Then the microbial products form the second pool, and then you get this stabilized components. Now, these are still all what we call as the active material, because we're talking a short period of time. But the thing that is interesting now is people are talking about microbial products, that the sugar actually left more soil, produced more soil organic matter than the wheat straw. This fits nicely into much of cable conagers and some of the German things, but they cannot find lignin in soil. I've talked about Watson's lignin protein, that lignin is not a significant component of soil organic matter, because the only way to break down lignin is via the oxidative enzymes. It's not incorporated into the microbial bodies, and therefore it's microbial products that are so important in the stabilization of this long-term material. I also got in trouble with Willy Horvath, Will, on this slide, because that's some global change thing. I got up and said we need to breed corn with a higher lignin content. And he reminded me that in the class day I had shown him this slide and that I changed my mind. I've gone back to lignin doesn't really matter. Next one. So that was the Saskatchewan. I was saying that we had one from working together with Ron Paul's on Colorado, where we take a wheat fallow soil that has 100% of the total carbon. The microbial biomass, and a lot of other people have found the same, you have a fairly active fraction that will grow on the subject, and a quite long-labeled fraction that will sit around for 14 years. Now remember, when we do the incubation, you are not talking about an inert microbial population just sitting there. This soil has decomposed 30% of its carbon during this incubation, so there's been a fair amount of substrate available for microbial growth. So these pools are a mixture of both resistance as well as growth during a long-term incubation. If you do your long-term incubation, do the kinetic analysis or curve analysis, as you saw from the previous ones, the active soil organic matter in this thing makes up about 8%, has a mean residence time very similar to that of the non-labeled microbial biomass. I don't think there's any doubt that one contributes to the other. The slow pool, as we've defined in here, makes up the difference between the active pool that has been determined kinetically and the resistant carbon that has been determined by acid hydrolysis. And that, in this soil, has a calculated mean residence time of 72 years. You acid hydrolyze the resistant soil, you're looking at 2,600 years, the total soil was 1,015. So within the soil, I think we have the ultimate of our range of times from 0.6 years to 2,600 years. And all of these affect how fast this soil is going to turn over. If you don't use incubation and acid hydrolysis, but use C13, the total soil is 100%. This soil has been sort of beat down and is not really plow treatment, is not really a recommended thing for farmers, and it should be that, because 70% of the soil is now composed of vegetation that was there 100 years ago. So we know it's going to be old. So that we have beat this thing down to basically all that's left is fairly resistant materials, and with C13 data, you get a mean residence time of 186 years. The light fraction comes in at 11 years, 108, and the palm, I've changed my name from inter-aggregate or thing to the particular aggregate within the aggregates, doesn't make up as large a percentage of the light fraction, and that's one of the reasons why this soil may, although it has a large component of resistant materials, still is very active when it turns over as far as fertility is concerned and incubation. But here the light fraction and the palm have the same mean residence times. That is different from many of the other soils we've studied. If you look at the C13 content in the silt, it's 199 years. In the coarse clays, it's 304 years. And as I said, either the Saskatchewan soils or the Colorado soils don't agree with each other. Here our fine clay is by far the oldest fraction. But the real take-home message from this slide is this value, which is our oldest value, and this value, and this value. The mean residence time that you get is going to depend on the length of your experiment. Everybody knows that. But nobody reports the length of the experiment. In the case of the carbon dating, we have a 10,000-year-old experiment. In the case of here, we have a 100-year experiment. And I would urge, as I'm going to say, if we're going to have really major advances, we're going to have to be very careful in our interpretation work out that everybody who does a tracer experiment reports it relative to the time of the decrease. I tried to come up with an overall model and see what they think, how you relate these things, but it's not that simple. Right now, if you can say MRT 10 years, or MRT for 100, it would help us a lot in our interpretation. The next one. So here is the data from Hal Collins on carbon dating in C13 of a series of corn belt soils. So the carbon dating is on the left-hand side, and the C13 is down the bottom. And the difference, the big difference is depth. As you go down in depth, the carbon dates get very old. The C13 also gets nice and old. So C13 is from the corn and native vegetation in this case. Tree switch that you do the calculation in about 100 years, the carbon dates. You get a nice linear relationship. The nice thing, at least, is there is a nice linear relationship, or reasonably good one, between the C13 age and the carbon dating age, and you can get a establishment that I have not yet used to calculate. So the young soils are the surface, then there's the medium, 25 to 57, and the very old soils getting up to 10,000 years. Now, I always get asked, is there something, and this is up to 100 centimeters, so this is the root set. It sort of blows your mind that you're looking at 10,000-year-old soils down there. In this case, it could be, many of these are silts, one of them is a glacial till. It could be that some of this carbon blew in with the silt. Everybody always asks me, is it charcoal? And we're having trouble finding charcoal. The next one, please. So as I start looking from the dynamics to the chemical structure, there's various ways, the biochemical defined, the sugars, polysaccharides, peptides, lignins, that are determined by two techniques and I report on one, pyrolysis mass spectrometry and NMR analysis, the functional groups, the carbonyl groups, the aromatic groups, the OAlkyl groups that are more done by infrared, that I'll also be talking about. We've talked about the humic fractions, so best we leave them alone for now. It's a functionally defined one, which has the biomass, the mineral associated. It's kinetically defined, where we do the incubation, do the resistant carbon that we have covered, and then the physical fractionations. So this sort of covers the approaches that are used to look at the different components. Thanks. So if you take a soil and burn it anaerobically in a stream of argon at 500 or 550 degrees, you'll get a bunch of smoke. If you run this smoke through a fancy system so it doesn't have interactions into a big mass spectrometer, you get a picture that looks like this. These are not specific compounds, but these are breakdown products due to the heat. Some of the lipids are specific ones that are there, but most of the other ones are breakdown products, but are then reproducible and are a good way to characterize the solid organic matter. Here's the case we're looking at the litter from Akron, Colorado, the same soil we were talking about before. And in this case, we get about 80% pyrolysis. In soils, we're more often down to, I'll show you some data after, 50 to 60% pyrolysis. So this is sort of the identification of that material which will come off. You have to remember when I talk about this thing, there's another component out there that hasn't come off in pyrolysis. So basically, if you look at the carbohydrates, the plant that is high in carbohydrates has some amino acids. It picks up the phenols. This pyrolysis technique is the Golden Energy Lab. They've got 3 units. Of course, it's very big in their biofuels as they're trying to get more cellulose and less lignin and all the materials that they're trying to grow. And this is their basic characterization technique for characterizing the plant material. And you get a fair number of unidentified material. Some of it is even up in the young at the 85 M over Z mass over charge. are basically molecular weight components. Next one. To simplify the data, here we have the Colorado grassland soils we were talking about before on the top that are in the native condition, and then we subtracted the signals for the cultivated. So it's a difference diagram. The other thing you need to know about these things, you're doing this as a normalized percentage of 100% of the signal, which normalizes for different carbon contents. But if something goes up, something else will probably go down on the system. And in a difference diagram, of course, if things are equal, it isn't even going to show up on this diagram. But very definitely, there's some fair number of sugars in the native soil that you don't see in the cultivated. But there are a fair number of other products, mostly proteinaceous, nitrogenous materials, that show up, the purpose ones, in the cultivated soil that don't show up in the native soil. We've expanded the area above 250, and you can see you still get a lot of nice signals. A lot of the lipids are in that higher molecular weight material. Next one. We've used acid hydrolysis, as I said, as our quick and dirty technique to get at the resistant fraction. It works. It always gives us a nice old resistant fraction, but we've always worried, what does it do to the system? Acid hydrolysis came from Bremner, who used it to measure amino acids and proteins in soil. It's used for carbohydrates and things like this. Alain Plante took the total soil, which is here, and then subtracted the non-acid hydrolyzable. And to our great surprise, the material that's non-hydrolyzable is basically carbohydrates. So you say, what the heck? If the textbooks are right, it should have come out in the first hydrolysis. But apparently, the acid hydrolysis is removing something, maybe sesame oxides, which are protecting the carbohydrates. And then now on pyrolysis, they come out. This also gets to me on my concept of humic acids. If I had thought that anything was aromatic and old and resistant, it would be the non-hydrolyzable portion. And the damn thing is mostly what we look upon as reasonably accessible materials. So even in my old age, I'm getting shocks. Next one, please. This is a PCA diagram. I usually hate PCA diagrams, but in this case, it allows me to do four things. That is just showing exactly what we saw beforehand. Those are the peaks that are dominant in the native soil. You have your carbohydrates, you have your proteins, and 94 is pure phenol. This comes not only from lignans, but of course comes from amino acids that have the phenolic components in many other places. Then you look at the cultivated, and there's a few nitrogenous constituents, as we saw before, that are typical of the cultivated. If you incubate that cultivated, and I'll show you some of the ages from that, the overall composition doesn't change a great deal. The acid hydrolysis gives a very different setting off by itself. At least it gives a unique pattern that isn't mucked up with the rest of them. So there's something that isn't protected acid hydrolysis that is quite different. But again, basically carbohydrates, some proteins, and one phenol. And these are, of course, are the major ones that make the differences in the PCA. And remember, in the pyrolysis, you are looking at those that burn off, not what's left behind. Next one. Francisco Calderon has a mid-infrared instrument at Akron, and we looked at the same soil, and the mid-infrared basically characterizes the functional groups as well as the silts and clays that are there. So here we looked at the different fractions that we're used to looking at. The first thing is when we look at the white there and the black, that is the soil where the carbonates have been removed. It sits very nice and tight too, but still distinct from it. We don't know whether that is due to the absorption of the mid-infrared by the carbonates or whether the acid treatment to take out the carbonates has taken out a bit of material. But of great interest is the fact that the fine clays form a very diverse, in one form, different group of compounds that don't foster at all. So again, the fine clays, there's something about those fine clays we need to do some more work on. The green is the particular organic matter plus the sand that sits over there. Then the silt is the yellow. And in all of our sites, these two sit fairly close together in their characteristics. Then you have the coarse clay in the blue, and the reds are the light fraction or that material which blows off. Lily's going to give me another pointer. Solo tea, Willie.
Top. Top of the ring.
Top of the ring. There you go. And you see, that's the difference between California and Washington.
He stole my pointer.
Yeah, he stole your pointer. He's getting it traded. And so the minute red, and Francisco had, for somebody who gave a talk this morning, a very nice one on the relationship between mid-infrared diffractions and the community diversity. Tomorrow, at the poster, Francisco is going to give more detail on this, on the fractions, and on the incubations that are done on the mid-infrared. Next one. I said I would come back to the overall aspect, so we take same aspect. So if the carbon at 1.7 carbon is 100%, we go to 100%, we cultivate it. Hey, gee, they've read the textbook. They've dropped to 64% in the surface. And then we incubate it. We drop another third. So that shows that the 800-day incubation did make a difference. So we went from 100 to 61 to 41. If you hydrolyze that native, 42% is non-hydrolyzable. You hydrolyze the cultivated, about half is non-hydrolyzable. So hydrolysis not only gives you a difference in age, it does give you more resistant materials as you decompose your materials. And then the other thing we said is if you pyrolyze this material, it doesn't remove as much carbon as the hydrolysis does, and all the way through as we look at these things. I'm really convinced that instead of acid hydrolysis, we should look at pyrolysis, because after all, it's an input of energy much similar to the organisms. That may be a better technique for getting an active fraction, a resistant fraction, that you can better characterize. The C13 really fits with the story. When you acid hydrolyze, you separate the amino acids and supposedly remove the, or leave behind the aromatics, although we showed to some extent that you don't necessarily. There's this big discrimination between hydrolysis. So I have not been able to use the C13 signal of the hydrolyzed as part of my calculation in the residence time because of this discrimination. And our native dated 193 years, the non-hydrolyzable 1994, the cultivated 1015, the non-hydrolyzable the cultivated 2658. And even this thing is susceptible to degradation during incubation, so the resistance is not really resistant. And it gets back to that over 4,000 year old fraction that's in the soil. The pyrolysis does a much better job of nitrogen. We've known that acid hydrolysis removes far more nitrogen than the bugs do. So if we look at the 100% of the initial, 79% in the cultivated, 66% in the cultivated incubated, we know that as the carbon gets blown off, the CN ratio narrows in soil and you get the nitrogen left behind. But the pyrolysis only leaves 58% of the nitrogen, and here it has 43%. So I really think this is a fairly easy technique. That's one thing we're going to investigate in fair detail as an alternative to this quick and easy method of getting a resistant fraction. Next one. Here's our California soils again. That's this, Colorado soil. Just because I have a California pointer, you see it here next to the Colorado native grasslands, the one we were talking before. There's the Colorado cultivated. There's the Kissimmee. Well, I guess I made the thing big so we could get at it, but now so we get the biggest thing because we have to get. We do that side and then we'll do the other one. There we go. So if we look at the North Dakota soil that's here, the Colorado native grassland, and the Texas grassland, we have a reasonably good mean annual temperature difference. Looking at global change, we're really interested in the effects of mean annual temperature. It's somewhat similar clay content. Soil organic matter going from 3% to 1.16 to 1.02, dropping as you go down in latitude and increasing mean annual temperature. If you look at the percent of the carbon respired in North Dakota, it's fairly resistant. I've said beforehand that the Colorado native grasslands really kicks off the carbon. The cultivated still kicks off a fair amount, and here the native grassland from Texas kicks this amount. If you do the kinetic analysis, you have 3.5% active fraction there, 8% active fraction. Cultivation certainly drops the active fraction as it should, and then Texas sits in there. Now, a lot of people are interested in the effect of temperature on the breakdown of resistant components. If temperature increases the breakdown of the resistant components, as we get global change, we're going to lose more of our resistant carbon and blow it off into the atmosphere. So we looked at the Q10 of the active pool, this is Michelle Haddix's work here on these pools, and of the resistant material. In all cases, the slow pool, which is not truly resistant, really resistant, remember, is a non-hydrolyzable slow pool, still comes out from about day 150 to day 800. And you get a nice difference in change in Q10. If you ask, if you pyrolyze this material, the 44 peak is interesting because it's the peak that comes off as CO2 during smoking. And the percent carbohydrates, 11%, 10%, you cultivate, you do drop the part and you sit back on that thing. Nitrogenous compounds, 22%, 20%, 18%, and 20%. Now, the latter two are very interesting ones because the Nebraska is a sandy soil that is 96% sand, about 3% clay, 1% other things sort of in that soil. And the alkaline soil that Elaine collected as part of our MAT gradient, but it's so different on the thing, with 20% mean annual temperature, and you can't really tell the clay content is only very low, but of course it's protected by the acetic oxides. So the 14%, look at that thing. It's practically inert to the bugs when you bring it into the lab. 2.4% was respired. The active fraction is very low. This is very low. The Q10 of slow pool is particularly high. Or I should say of the slow pool. So we question, was this chemical recalcitrance that controlled the Irini secretion, which controls enzyme hydrolysis, also affected by clay microbial organic matter interactions, or does it only affect the chemistry? It certainly is affected by the alkane here because you have a very important high temperature interactions with the clay. And here we see that the carbohydrate content is higher than anything else, and the nitrogen content is as high as anything except the nitrogen content of the sand. So here we have a comparison that should be all chemical recalcitrance because there's no clays there to act. Here is one that you have huge matrix protection, and yet both of them have somewhat similar carbohydrates and nitrogen compounds. Can I have the next slide, please? So Myrna Simpson convinced her we had pretty nice samples, said she'd run the NMR for us. So the beginning of the same thing, mean annual temperature, the clay contents, the native grasses, percent CO2 evolved is the same. The NMR people love the alkyl carbon, which is the carbons that are associated with the C2H3 groups of lipids, amino acids, the ones that don't have the oxygen materials on them, within the grassland, makes up a fairly consistent amount of materials, but in the allophanes are much lower, so there's much less of the lipid long chain aliphatic carbon in there. The bulk of the carbohydrates and the amino acids make up about 36% here, high percentage, 46% in the sand, and 51% in the allophane. And the aromatics, I've read the textbook. North Dakota is a little bit higher in aromatics, it's a little bit more resistant to decomposition. when you take 100 years of cultivation, the aromatics do go up, so they are somewhat in the resistant phase. But you get to the native grass, and if it's not any with it, where there would be recalcitrance, it would be in the sandy soil because there's no place to protect it. So I thought that maybe the recalcitrance would be the dominant ones, and we have no indication that the aromatics have come up in a month, and they're not higher in Costa Rica. Now, this shows something that I have always said. I have to do the damn thing to be able to understand it. You have to sort of make your own mistakes. I always assumed, read about the allophanes and never worked on them before, that the allophanes protected humified materials. They don't. They're protecting young materials. And I talked to somebody who knows allophanes and says, well, we knew that. But it's very, very interesting that what we think of the very resistant materials to decomposition are otherwise protected materials. Now, there's a very nice paper out of Holland recently that says this allophane is not so much as a clay cesspit oxide protection, as it is a formation of very small aggregates with the cesspit oxide that are then protected from attack. Next one. This is the same Halsey soil, the 96% sand that I've shown you, where 100 years ago, under the mistaken impression that trees would bring rain to the sand hills of Nebraska, they planted thousands and thousands of acres of trees. Didn't bring rain, but made a phenomenal research site. Here we have the prairie soil, a pine soil, and a cedar soil that were planted on the thing. You can use your C13 content, because the prairie was a mixed prairie to start with, to calculate the percent of the prairie remaining, and then calculate the mean residence time. Under pine, there is degradation of the original prairie carbon. So what's new about that? This is approaching fossilization. We've known well and more for 130 years that under pines you do get degradation. But under the cedar, which is both an endomycorrhizal, and depending who I talk to, they say it's endomycorrhizal, or it also strongly recirculates calcium. Believe it or not, you get 82% of the prairie carbon remaining after 70 years, whereas when we incubated the thing in the lab, we only had 75% remaining after 500 days. And I think, in addition to some of the differences in vegetation, very definitely the effect of some calcium protection, it's disturbance. And I'll come back to disturbance. If you leave that thing disturbed, we know very well any farmer who tried to farm that sandy soil immediately lost all his organic matter and was left blew off. And that fitting in with the zero till thing, that the lack of disturbance of even without, there's not much aggregates in the sandy soil, even without aggregates, but the lack of disturbance is really a major controlling factor that we have to look at in more detail. Next one. A lot of us are doing the C13O2 of incubated samples now with the stabilized isotope program incubating, and this has been one of the most miserable things for me to analyze I've run into, so I decided to show some slides. If you do the forest soil from KBS, there's the soil after incubation. It doesn't jiggle around too much, and they behave themselves. The CO2 shows some discrimination through the microorganism and is a little bit more negative than the soil total. If you do the acrid soil, one we talked about before, the loam textured soil, it jumps around more than you'd like to if you're going to do interpretations. But it does at least stay below the soil. But this Halsey prairie soil, I haven't figured out. It starts at where the soil started, but it drops to 4 per mil. So the incubation, the bugs are doing exactly the same thing to the discrimination aspect that the acid hydrolysis is, that you're getting much more negative. Now, this could be due to two reasons. It could be that we have a mixed prairie there, that the organisms are decomposing C4 rather than C3 material early on, and what's left over is C3 plant material. And this fits with the fact that all the ranchers know that the cows differentiate between a C3 and C4 grassland needing. The other thing, it could be a chemical composition factor of breaking down the less negative amino acid carbohydrates and leaving in behind things. And I don't know which of those two. I keep saying I'm going to bring out throw things for you young people to work on and answer the questions on. Be careful, I'm going to try and stay in there for a few more years yet too. The next one, Rick. And here I'm switching to Kellogg Biological Station as shown before to repeat again what we've done before, the long-term incubation, and I'm just going to stay at the bottom slide. So it took the soil, and here to confuse you, my light fraction is called interaggregate, and the POM is called intraaggregate, which is probably the best definition there is of the materials, between aggregates and this inaggregate of the materials. And so after incubation, we looked at the light fraction. It's gone down from 4.5 to 2.9% of the carbon. It's gone down more than that because remember we've lost a fair amount of carbon during the incubation. So if you're always expressing a split there, you have to be careful that these ratios also change. But the important thing is that the corn-derived carbon, after 10 years of corn, in what we think of as light, easily decomposable fraction, just makes up 27% of this material. After 10 years, there's a lot of material in the light fraction that's old. The first thing you look for is charcoal, because it floats. But I don't think there's much charcoal in there. But you can separate out the mean residence time of the corn carbon from the non-corn carbon, and at least they behave themselves. The mean residence time of corn carbon is much faster than that of the non-corn carbon. But none of these pools is clean. They give you nice averages, nice separations, but you have to realize that soil mixes and there's a continual interchange, and to get a very clean, absolute isolated fraction ain't going to happen. So if you look at the silt, we have again some mean residence time of the corn carbon, 9.7 years, and non-carbon, 4.7 years. And here the silt is slightly older than the total clay. So the soils do vary a great deal on the amount of protection. Overall, this soil is a previous forest soil is much younger than the Ackland soil. If I can have the next slide. I said that nitrogen was important. Here's work of Glenn Harris's, where he added N15 ammonium sulfate or N15 red clover to a soil at Rodale. And there's some very important things to point out. In the conventional, typical 39% uptake by the crop, we tend to forget that there is reasonable uptake by the soil too, and by the microbial biomass that comes out. But the thing that has always struck me is how fast that nitrogen enters what I call a slow pool. The second year after fertilization, they know you get damn little out. You only got 1% of nitrogen out from the fertilized crop, and the microbial biomass dropped too. If we look at the loss of the first year, it was 38%, the second year was 5%, so we had 43% loss, which is so typical of many N15 experiments. But now let's look at the organic treatment. You weren't feeding the crop, you were feeding the soil and the microbial biomass. And the organic people have known that for a long period of time. 1 year ain't going to do it. You need to build up your pools over a number of years, which will then mineralize. Then in year two, you did get not a great deal from the crop. Once you get in the soil, even if it's organic, it sits there pretty tightly. But the big thing is that you get 18% loss if you don't take special treatment to protect that nitrate and nitrogen in the off-season cropping, get the losses. Well, there's two things from this. Is if you're going to do this and talk about organics, you're definitely going to have to manage the system throughout the year so that you don't get the losses. The other thing is you don't report data like this to the organic farmers who are supporting your data because you automatically lose your grants. When you're horrified by these loss figures. Now, I want to use this as a point to the future. I think the people in this room know exactly how to take that loss down to zero. We have fundamental factors in what's going on. The problems are socio-economic. But should we sit back and say, let somebody else do it? Or should we say, it is our responsibility to drop that loss on nitrogen. Not only because it's going out through the Mississippi, but now with global change, the N2O is much more important than the carbon sequestration. And I think a challenge that we should have is to, in both cases, try to mix this nitrogen loss to the environment very close to zero and have quite sure you people can do it. Next one, slide. Something that's very interesting that came from the studies, Jose Sanchez and Dick Harwood working on this thing, found out that as we know, corn is a phenomenal crop, but corn is also hard on the soil. They compared bare fallow, corn, and wheat in nitrogen uptake and found out, I would have thought that the bare fallow had the largest amount, but this fits with a lot of other European researchers, that crops do increase the mineralization of available nitrogen if it has been preconditioned. This is where you've had it in the rotations, you've got some of this nitrogen that has previously either been put in by manure or by a legume. And so there's this very interesting aspect that there's something in the corn rhizosphere. It could be wetting and drying, but I think it's the organisms that we have not really understood. A really good project for the molecular biologists to look at what is there in this corn rhizosphere that is giving this high mineralization of the soil organic matter under the corn crop. And I didn't believe it, so I went in after the crop and did a mineralization study, and sure enough, we got far more out of the bare and out of the wheat than out of the corn. So the corn had actually stripped that nitrogen out of that soil. The next one. I'm switching to something else. Will Horvath's data, we're going to get it published. That the modern flux experiments are asking a major question: what is the beneath ground production? What is the respiration? And a lot of us have information that can help the eddy flux people on some of the studies. So we'll label large crop of trees, well, fairly large, bigger than he was, in the field, and we fit 24% of the labor went into the leaves and litter, 48% in the stems and branches, very small amount into the roots, larger amounts into the coarser roots. Root and soil respiration during the labor made up 7.7%, microbial biomass about 0.4% of the labor in the 2 weeks, which is pretty good for that system. Now, these poplars were very interesting. They were about 5 years old, and they were just at the switch between the endo and the ecto mycorrhizae. And we know the poplars, willows, and some of these things switch, and they were getting a lot of new growth fungi. Now the question you'd ask yourself, is a mycorrhiza autotrophic or heterotrophic respiration? The answer is, I don't know. The people with the fluxes are really trying to answer. The easy way of saying, the endos, which are basically within the plants, are very definitely autotrophic. A large portion of the ectomycorrhiza are probably, you could call them soil respiration, even though they're directly hooked onto. Then you go back after nearly a year, of course you've lost your label from the leaves because you have a new batch of label, some movement out of the stems, some movement out of the roots, but an increase in movement in the greater than 0.5 millimeter roots from here to here. We picked up double the soil respiration. That's still not very much for soil respiration from the trees, and very valuable data has been tried to interpret, and a drop in microbial biomass, and an increase in the soil as we transfer from some of the plant material to the soil. Can I have the next slide, Ray? This is work that Reg QC did in the lab, asking the same question, but in here case, said, what is the cost of mycorrhizal and of nitrogen fixation? Working with a bean plant, and again, tracer nitrogen, expressing it 100% that came in on the thing. And if you look at the fixation rate, the free living one, 7.0, and this was in a soil with fertilizer added to it, the mycorrhizal did improve the fixation rate slightly, rhizobial increased it, and the mycorrhizal increased it. However, when you look at the shoot weight, the mycorrhizal increased the shoot weight, but under these conditions, the rhizobium were parasitic because they didn't need all the nitrogen, so they decreased the amount of plant. A very interesting aspect of this is that the ability of the plants can compensate for the need of their partners. It's a very important point to also say. And the other thing is, if you look at these respirations, these are so much higher than the field respirations that we show. The other thing that's important is that the mycorrhizal has less carbon going to it and is not nearly as demanding as the nodule in nitrogen fixation. We heard the talk this morning how energy requiring nitrogen fixation is, and it's shown in here that nitrogen fixation does require a lot of the plant's economy in energy. Next one, please. Bill Parton's work, he analyzed the LIDA study, which is very many studies across many sites on litter decomposition, and came up with the interesting conclusion that in litter, if you take the climate, the lignin to nitrogen ratio into account, you can account for 68% of the variability in litter decomposition. That led Matt Wallenstein to say, who's also out there, well, that leaves 32% for the microorganisms and everything else for the decomposition. But remember, this is litter, and so you don't have the soil effects. But the one big difference that I want to talk about was the oaks. And other people have shown that if you take oak leaves out into the prairie, they don't decompose as fast as they do in the native system. And I assume the molecular biologists will find out that the white rots aren't there to do the decomposition. The oak leaves put out a KBS, which is an agricultural system, right here, that was formerly forested, but still has oak leaves being blown in by the wind, broke down as fast as in the forest. So the next one. Looking at ammonium sulfate in litter added to soil underneath, a small amount of the nitrogen that gets added to the forest soil in Steve Hartsford will get snuck by the fungi up into the litter. So there is a connection between the litter and the soil on the thing. But the very interesting aspect that went into the soil, organic matter, into the microbial biomass, and with time, microbial biomass in this case increased and then decreased. I think there's a phenomenal amount of nitrogen turnover data that we could use in to calculate some of the dynamics that we haven't used. And someday when I have time, I'm going to try to bring that meta-analysis of all that 50s to 70 years data on N15 to look at microbial biomass and solid organic matter turnover based on nitrogen rather than carbon. Nitrogen doesn't have the isotope tracers for the easy studies to even the amounts of work on that. The next one. So we're talking about litter, and there's a very nice, fairly complicated calculation that all of the baseball guys have done that tells how much of an advantage, how many more home runs you hit at home than away. Ed Ayers used exactly the same calculation to look at the effect of community structure. Does our litter that is placed at home, aspirin, under aspirin, decompose as fast as the litter decomposing elsewhere? And that fits in with the story that 68% is so much defined by the climate and think the microorganisms don't really matter. So about 5% of the aspirin degraded, there's about 5% faster degradation of the aspirin in the early days of the litter, and 5% in the pine in the later days, and the pine had much wider lignin to N ratio, and that made sense. And just to give some indication of pyrolysis, this without the soil, so you get a high pyrolysis efficiency. Next one, please. Here's the aspirin litter, same thing as forest litter, but there's more alkyl aromatics and phenols as there should be in the litter. Still get your carbohydrates and your amino acids. Next one. Same story we had here. Here we have the aspirin litter put into the aspirin stand. So the stuff beneath should be microbial products because that's been produced in the aspirin stand. There's a very interesting thing that I want to bring in here. There's some high molecular weight fatty acids up here that occur in the aspirin initially, and they disappear after the litter, and they show up as 140 molecular weight compounds afterwards. So here's a case of microbial transformation of a material as well as degradation to form soil organic matter. And I think we always look at how much is the microorganism decomposed, how much is the body's down the myocardium to actually just transform some of the compounds and then form more resistant material. This is litter, but not so organic, so be it. Next one. In the long-term incubation, if you look at the thing, the last 40 days, you're nearly at steady state. You get a very low amount of CO2 coming off. I talked about disturbance. If you take this controlled soil and mix it, you don't get a little bit more, but if you do a second mixing, you get a huge breakdown of material that has been sitting there for 700 days. We thought it was recalcitrant, but again, disturbance is very, very important. Have you broken on aggregates and just made it more available to the microbes? Here, we added the litter in this soil. The first 21 days didn't decompose quite as fast as the second. So this, of our six soils that we studied, is one case where it was very low soil organic matter. The organisms had lost 50% of their microbial biomass. They were still capable of decomposing, but not quite as fast as when you primed them up a little bit and gave them a second decomposition. Next one, please. So here's the study. We had 36% of our substrate transpired. In the pre-ink, we had 31, a little bit less. In the naked, we cultivated double much. And here, a much lower amount. Chloroform fumigation, carbon, and I'm not too sure I pressed chloroform fumigation extraction. We gave 272, we have a nice 50% drop on the 707A or the pre-incubated samples as they came. So the microbial biomass, I dropped about in half, which fits in with the earlier slides there. So now, with C13, you measure the CO2, you measure the increased turnover of the salt carbon. So the question, we asked two questions. Were the microorganisms still capable of breaking down salt organic matter? Two, if you gave them an extra substrate, gave them supper, could they then attack the salt organic matter? You get a slight amount of C13 off from the soil, which I don't call priming, but call increased turnover. The original definition of priming was it had to be a net loss of salt organic matter. You still have 400 micrograms of this material left over. So by the original definition of priming, we did not have priming, but we did have an increased turnover. But also, this 36 relative to the biomass could just be a turnover of the biomass. So I conclude from these studies that our organisms, when given a substrate on a very old soil, don't attack the old resistant material. Can I have an excellent place? So, Suhanna and Chris Blackman showed some of the organisms. He said, well, since we're doing all this study on the organisms, let's look at what the community composition is. And the effect of native versus cultivated was very effective. The effect of the 0 and 700 days was very different. But in the bacteria, there was no change in the community composition during the time after substrate addition. Either there was no change in community composition, or the doggone bacteria got to sleep and weren't growing. You can't tell the difference. Only direct microscopy will tell us. I can't believe that from knowing the plant substrates, we know that fungi are the major decomposers, but some of the bacteria do grow, but they didn't change in composition. I looked at some of the names. This one here is an actinomycete. There's an interesting breaking down of phenyl bacteria, which is interesting. So it breaks down more complex molecules. It went up in numbers, and some of the other numbers. Dilovibrio is one I worked on many years ago. It's a bacterial parasite that broke down all this. The fungi had effects of all of the different treatments and the addition. And the organisms that you look at, even though they're molecular biology, I did ask Chris where you can put in ordinary names that the old timers can recognize to put in these. The Cryptococcus is the yeast forming basidiomycete. The Mortiella, the Gibberella, is the sexual equivalent to the Fusarium. But these are organisms that are basically sugar fungi that have changed. We're going to have to look in very, very detail. Princeton's gone and I'll have to look at the acidomyces in particular to see if you get more detail, whether you get actually more resistant. But its initial stages, even during the 700-day incubation and then during the substrate additions, you are getting the more commonly isolated fungi that we have known for a long period of time. The next one. In conclusion, going back to KBS, if you ever want to test yourself and show how little you know, try and put all your data into an ecosystem concept and make it balance out. We're fairly good under the carbon. Here we have a run of the poplar, here we're under a corbaned system. The carbon content has gone up under the carbon. The active fraction is up 5%, the slope 52, and the resistance. But this is averaged down to depth. And this is where the problem is. I'm comfortable with doing the incubation resistance at the surface. But if we bring the subsurface soil into the lab and disturb it, it blows off carbon like crazy. So we have to twist some modeling buttons when we model this and reduce the amount of carbon coming out of the surface from the subsurface by 50%. And the model of Earth, Schulten, this model, we got a pretty good fit of CO2 release relative to the decomposition factors. But here's where the problem comes in. If you ask yourself, okay, we know what the organisms are, what do they do? We did thymidine incorporation of bacteria, we did biomass of bacteria, did some growth rates of bacteria, and concluded that in the poplars, about 10% of the carbon came from the system from bacteria. I've talked about the ectoadiotrophic mycorrhizae, the fungi hypoxia is 6%. The fauna, I just went to literature values and put the standard value of 10% on the fungi, fauna, and the roots are pretty good. The corn and soybean, much more bacteria because there's lower fungi, and the fauna are about the same. And I think the error estimates on this are plus or minus percent. In all honesty. And there's only two or three papers of ELSA that have tried that and they got about the same error estimates. But yeah, if you really claim we know what you're doing, we should be able to make simple calculations like this. Next one. So it's time to test hypothesis. I said earlier, we really push this thing. Incubation C3, C4 replacement, specific product analysis, which I didn't talk about, provide a firm base of knowledge and great hope for the future. We need to tie it together with good fractionation modeling studies. Many of us are disregarding the golden age of tracer work when there is a wealth of data that is still applicable, and I urge anybody who's going into tracers to dig that old literature up, because there's a really wonderful set of still very applicable data that hopefully will not be repeated. Sometimes in my most miserable moments, I'm scared that they read the thing but disregarded it so they can publish the paper, but I won't admit that. I've asked them to express the data on the basis of length of the study to normalize short and long-term study, and discrimination does occur, and we should take it into account in our calculations. Next one, please. Molecular structure analysis, NMR, mid-IR, pyrolysis, I've shown some of the newer works that work really at the fine scale, tied to dynamics, are going to give us a phenomenal amount of information. Humic acids, I have a question right before. There's some publications that say they don't exist. There's a whole society, the IHSS, and I'm quite sure there's some representatives here. You've got to fire a returning salvo on the importance of humic acids. The soil matrix, recalcitrant disturbance, I think are very, very important factors that we have not taken into account enough. The next one. Do microbes matter? Of course they do. The techniques for community diversity soil management are now available, fast reproducible. Microbes are catalysts. How much of the redundancy of microbes really affects decomposition? It looks like a little bit. Community diversity, redundancy, growth, CO2. Next one, please. Global change, ecosystem processes, biofuels, the challenges out there, it's spelled cycling wrong, I see, is, I think the biggest thing is to get the nitrogen loss into control that we should be working at. The other thing I would beg for is that we can't have internal standards. When you do a microbial biomass, you can't do internal standards. But I beg that at least you do two different techniques and say at least my chloroform fumigation extraction is the same as a direct microscopy, or at least within one order of magnitude. And where we have chemistry, we really should be doing more internal standards and we should be sending them around, cross-referencing the data. And the other thing about it is all of these data sets, all of the molecular biology data sets are so big, we're going to have to really work with data management. We're going to put all of our pyrolysis, you know, online so other people can use it. But I think somehow we're going to have the Europeans ahead of us get a soil science data management, data storage thing so that people have access to this phenomenal amount of information that we can use to interpret. And I'm really in favor of doing multiple sites. I try not to accept a paper for publication when I'm a miserable reviewer that's only in one soil. And and saying, well, what happens next one? Unless you have sensitive. And long-term sites are especially important. And then the last one. Thank you very much.
Now we have time for a few questions for Elder.
So if we're going to get the nitrogen losses down to zero, right? So you put up Glenn Harrison, you know, and he lost 18%. And then you put up Steve Hartz, right? He put N15 out in the data system. He lost even more. So do you believe in uncontrollable nitrogen losses? And if the data systems can't sustain it, how are we going to engineer the access?
In the first place, I'd start as a biofuel where there should be enough money to do these. And say, damn it all, before we gave you the license for biofuels, you have to guarantee you're not going to lose that. So I'd start. The other thing I'd start, now imagine the story in Michigan when I was there. Data farmers were putting on 300 pounds of nitrogen whether they needed it or not. And they said, we need no more nitrogen resources. And I didn't get EPA on their tail, but somebody else did. When EPA got on their tail, they came to me and said, Elder, I've got to fix it. Well, we dropped the nitrogen inputs by 25% and increased quality. So we can do it under very specific aspects. And I think we need to start at those. And we should be able to get the corn under much more of a spoon-fed, carbon crop, sponge crop type of system. We know it can be done. But it's not, but you have the nature, how are you going to change things? There's no doubt about it. The excess nitrogen is there, it's going to go off the atmosphere, it's going to go into the water. That's a rule of law.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I'll ask. You talked a lot about prairie soils, threatened model soils, and septisol in Colorado. And I know you've worked with perhaps tropical soils. How do those other kinds of soils maybe change the picture that you talked about here?
The part of mean annual temperature gradients we have in Brazil, forest salt. The elephant, of course, is also salt as well.
Yeah.
And the question that Nancy brought to me is, we need to do in agriculture with tropical forest systems is keep all the nutrients within the plant rotational system. I didn't show the Brazilian soils, but they didn't behave relative to my story. They did on basic chemistry, but on decomposition. I didn't know enough about them to look at them. But so these tropical soils are deep, but again, I think if we could mimic the trees a little bit more and keep our nutrients within the plant microbial system, it's what we should expect.
Okay. Further questions? Mary?
Yes, Elder, you said that when you go into subsoil and remove that and expose that carbon to decomposition, it just blows it off really quickly.
Nearly as fast as the surface, even though it's 10,000 years.
Okay, so then, does that mean even though it's old, it's not resistant?
That's
so what are, how
can protected by disturbance, or lack of disturbance. The organism is coming off from down there, and we have a little bit of carbon here, we got five here, they got off.
Okay.
So that's the way I'm best to look at it, because I don't think there's much aggregation down there. But the subsoil has not been worked on as much as it should, as we're looking at global change.
So
much more variable than the surface. The very definitely, if you disturb the subsoil, it will blow off the carbon.
Is there a way to make that carbon more resistant before it gets into the subsurface? Is it leachable carbon, do you think?
Well, most of the soils I was working with, these are dry land, semi-dry land soils. There's not a huge amount of dissolved organic matter going down the depth. Of course, the soil would be the leachable carbon. How do you expect it? Well, there's those people. Well, if you're in Canada where it's cold as hell, you take it down deep, you bury it, and you cultivate it, but lose any more soil than the no till. And there are a fair number of people saying, let's get that carbon incorporated at depth where there's not going to be decomposition. I think we don't know enough about decomposition at depth to really understand this. But the other night study, that root carbon is much more resistant to decomposition than the background carbon. And that would help you on the same story. And as you go deeper, you get less food carbon, and then have more soup and have less decomposition. So there's a very interesting story on the depth that you people need to work on.
Okay.
Okay. Before we adjourn, I'd like to thank Elder for a very interesting talk covering many decades of research. And I'd like to present you with the plaque, which says, "From the Soil Science Society of America, recognizes Elder Paul as a distinguished scholar presenting the 2011 Francis E. Clark Distinguished Lectureship on Soil Biology." That's a long sentence. So thank you.